Josh. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for speaking. I'm Kyle. And congratulations to everyone that got chips. I found out this morning that I have a double ear infection. So it kind of sounds like I have squirrels chirping in my ear. And so that's going to throw me off a little bit. But we're going to roll with it anyways. My sobriety date is July 8th of 2005. I have a sponsor. His name's Daniel. He has a sponsor. And I sponsor others. This is my home group. I love this group. Through the years, I have seen this group grow and shrink and grow and shrink and grow. And, you know, it's an amazing thing to be a part of, and it's an even better thing to be able to give back to it. So, my story is similar to a lot. I have two brothers. My dad's military, and now he's actually a minister. You know, we had a pretty good childhood. Really, I can't complain a whole lot. We were loved. We got to do a lot of fun things. I think the fact that I had two brothers, you know, who we got along with each other so well, that it was even better because of that. You know, building forts and jumping our bikes and, you know, just doing stuff that kids do, you know. I can't really place a time where I felt that out of place feeling until later in my life. We never really had alcohol in our house. My mom's dad died a recovering alcoholic, 35 years. Both my mom's brothers are recovering alcoholics. I'm an alcoholic. My younger brother's an alcoholic. So obviously it runs in our family. So because of that, my parents didn't have alcohol in our house. And that was probably a wise decision on their part. I didn't really have a whole lot of interest in it either at first. A good time for me was playing G.I. Joes in the backyard or digging a hole with my brothers, you know, to see who could fall in it first. As you grow up, you get introduced to different things. And I went to Christian school, also a private school, until sixth grade. Wore uniforms, so it's hard to feel out of place when everybody's wearing the same thing. Didn't really struggle with the God thing too much, you know, was pretty into that. I was a perfectionist, though. Things needed to be exact, or I wasn't doing it properly. So, junior high school rolls around. We moved around a lot, being my dad's Navy. So I made friends pretty quickly, but I also was able to put on the salesman, you know, this is the guy I want you to meet, you know, because, you know, in a year or two I'm going to be gone, so you're not going to really get to know me. But we finally settled into a place, Orange Park, Florida, which is just outside of Jacksonville. And I made some really, really good friends. They're still friends to this day. A good time then was listening to Candlebox while we're playing Tecmo Super Bowl or basketball in my friend Brian's front yard until, you know, it's dark. You know, and I didn't really want for anything else at that time, but Summer before my senior year, I hadn't had a drink until then. We decided to have some of the girls in our friend group over, and we got some wine coolers and Zima, and I may be dating myself a little bit with some of you, but my first drunk was on Zima. Yeah, without the Jolly Rancher, I had to at least step up that game a little bit. But, and I loved it, you know. That fear of being the chubby kid, you know, didn't really bother me, you know. There was a girl there that I liked, and, you know, I was able to not have any inhibitions, you know, any second-guessing, any fears, you know, the fears that controlled my life. All those went away, you know. That's what alcohol did for me. It made me be able to become the man that I, or the boy at that time, but the person that I wanted to be, I thought. And in that time, you know, I probably would have drunk till I blacked out, but we had a limited supply. We were 17, so. But I did make the decision at that point that, you know, I was going to do this as often as I could. And we set out to do that. You know, it wasn't long after that that we were having parties at my other friend's house, and I drank an entire fifth of Goldschlager all by myself. And, you know, it was fun. You know, I obviously had alcohol poisoning, you know. It was fun for me, you know, but for my friends, you know, it started to not be as fun, you know, to drink around me, because I'm running around with beer bottles, I'm drunk, you know, God knows I couldn't swim, you know, it's by a pool, you know, so I've got friends trying to make sure that I don't fall in the pool or drop beer bottles by the pool, or, you know, I tried to entertain them, and this one's for Blair, with, you know, trying to be the walrus man, and, God, that's stupid, but, yeah, I'll tell you about that later, but, you know, I was enjoying it, but obviously there was an issue, you know, even from, you know, I hadn't even been drinking a year yet, and there was a problem. And all the things I mentioned before, you know, the perfectionism, the family being alcoholics, all that stuff, you know, that those things aren't what make me an alcoholic. You know, what the book talks about, and I believe for me, is that I am alcohol because I have the obsession of the mind and the craving of the body. So, and I'll get into that when I get into the steps. About the time that I started having that feeling that a lot of people that I've talked to in these rooms have, was it was right before that summer. I played football, I was on the weightlifting team, you know, I was a jock, you know, and there was a younger classman who was becoming stronger than me on the weightlifting team, and I didn't deal with that well, so I proceeded to tease him as much as I could on the way home from a weightlifting match, just giving it to him rough. And we got back to the locker room, and we changed, and he was walking back out, and I was going to lay into him one more time, you know, so I'm like this and this and that, and poking him in the chest, like just a real asshole, you know. And I look away for a minute because the coach walks in with a cheerleader, so I turn my head, and he cold cocks me, boom, and knocks me out in one punch, like stiff, fall back, hit a bench, just bad, you know. And I deserved it. I internalized a lot of those feelings of shame, and I used that stuff to drive my drinking. So, the drinking like that progressed. I graduated from high school. I was a good student. I had a Bright Future scholarship. I went to University of North Florida. I made it there about 6 weeks, because because I just didn't go to class. I wasn't really drinking a ton, but I was more interested in being a part of the crazy crowd. You know, I loved the lifestyle of the insanity. You know, a lot of that drew me to, you know, being involved in a lot of this stuff. Again, not a reason I'm alcoholic, but it was just appealing to me. So, you know, we're listening to punk rock music and you know, dyeing my hair blue, and I was known as Mosh Pit Josh, and that was pretty awesome. But, you know, I sold my skateboard for a carton of Marble Reds and just, you know, just making really poor decisions. You know, flunked out of University of North Florida. Went back home with Mom and Dad. You know, Mom and Dad are there to, they're going to save everything for me. And I went to, I got a job. You know, it was a good job. I sold video games. And I was getting high a lot, so that worked out. And, you know, I still wasn't really doing anything. I decided that, you know, college is what I needed to do to fix my life again. So I went to the local community college. Again, didn't really go to class. I helped get second place in a pool tournament for them. But that was about it, you know. It was a lot of wasted money. I'd moved into an apartment with some friends, same guys that I started drinking with, and you know, our house became the party house, and we were dealing in other outside substances at the time. And didn't really have too many run-ins with the law or anything, but you know, the progressive nature got just worse and worse and worse. You know, the amounts that I was drinking to get to the place where I needed to be to feel even normal got exaggerated. I decided to have my first geographical change. I was living here in Tampa. No, I was living in Jacksonville, and my parents were about to move here to Tampa. My dad was to take a new job. And I knew something needed to change. I didn't know what it was, but I felt like getting away from that old lifestyle is something that I needed to do. So I left, I came here, and I was working in the restaurant industry as a cook, you know, and it's a tough lifestyle for somebody who's trying to get away from drugs and alcohol. And, you know, I came to work at the, you know, for the same company I was working for in a new location, and it just continued, you know, I met the same kind of people because that's what I wanted to do, and I fell into the same things, you know, started getting involved in harder outside substances, and it really drug me to a bottom a lot more quickly. After a while, I decided that that geographic change wasn't enough, and what I really needed was the military to straighten me out. So I went on a 5-day cocaine binge and then went and joined the Navy. It was the delayed entry program, meaning that you do everything except for swearing for the last time. So you're not technically in, but you have a ship date that's in the future. So I had 8 months until I was going to ship out. And in that 8 months, you know, I told my parents, you know, I'm going to go back to Jacksonville. I'm going to live with my friends there. You know, I'm just going to live it up until this happens. And in that 8 months, you know, it would be a lie to tell you that it was all bad times. You know, I had a lot of great times, you know, and you hear it all the time, but if drinking was so terrible, you know, I probably probably wouldn't be here. But, you know, I loved it. And it was a lot of good times. So the time to ship out came. I had switched from doing the white powdery substance to being a purely beer drinker. So obviously my weight became an issue. And I was overweight to ship out, and so I didn't go, you know. And really, that was my last hope, you know. I didn't know how to change my life. I figured I put all my eggs in that basket. You know, the military is what's going to do it for me. You know, that's what's going to change my life. They're going to give me structure. They're going to keep me on a short leash. You know, I'm not going to have any freedoms to screw up myself. These are my thoughts. I know that Bill could probably tell you otherwise, but... this is what I thought would be this is my escape plan from the life that I was living, and it was gone. So, at that point, you know, after living on my friend's couch for 8 months before the ship out, and I wasn't exactly the best roommate, they wouldn't let me come back to stay with them. My parents were done with me. The only person that would take me in was my younger brother, and you know, he was doing pretty well for himself. He was a sous chef at a fancy restaurant and had a nice apartment, and I came and slept in the closet in that apartment on a futon mattress that wasn't on a futon, it was just on the ground. And I had about 2 egg crates worth of clothes. At that point, you know, I was ashamed of myself. I'd lost hope. You know, one of those, I'm not going to shave today because I can't look at myself in the mirror from what happened last night. Or, you know, I'm so full of alcohol all the time that I can't even bring myself to do my laundry. So instead of washing my work clothes, you know, that are full of grease and food smell, I'll just go to Walmart and buy a new shirt for $5. You know, just pitiful, you know. And it's good to hear myself say that, because, you know, you forget those things being away from it, you know, for a while. You know, there was a one night that I came home from, well, it wasn't even my home. I came to my brother's apartment after a night of drinking and just tanked, you know, came in. You know, I don't know how I didn't kill myself or someone else, you know. I was having blackouts all the time, you know, losing friendships over running my mouth and not remembering what I said. But this night I came home, I passed out, and then I wake up to my younger brother shaking me, saying, you know, wake up, you just pissed all over my clothes, why did you do that? And I didn't remember doing it, you know, and I wasn't wrong for anything ever at that point. So, you know, I was like, what are you talking about? You know, I didn't do that. You know, I don't know what you're talking about. So, you know, the last person that really put their hand out for me, you know, I got mad and jumped in my car and drove and woke up the next morning. And I'm sitting up from the seat of my car to look around to where I'm at. And I had driven over a curb. I'm in this church playground. And there's kids playing, you know. And I'm just like, you know, what the hell am I doing? You know, where am I at? And, you know, I just treated the people that loved me horribly, you know. The same brother... You know, I used to get in arguments with him that I was a better drummer than Jimmy Chamberlain, who some of you may know, Smashing Pumpkins drummer. And I've never played a drum set in my life. You know, just crazy, craziness. You know, he's the only guy that'll take me in, and I'm hitting him with broomsticks and pushing him down. And just a real asshole. And, so, back up just a little bit. Sorry. I'd gotten a DUI in 2003, and did the DUI counterattack and all that stuff. It was here in Hillsborough County. They had told me that I needed to go to like 2 meetings a week, and that I needed to continue to go to these meetings. And, you know, one of the paper signers, you know, I was one of those. And so I went to this meeting that was in the church that we were going to, because I was still living with my parents. And, you know, there was people just telling me what I needed to do. You know, they were, and not trying to tell me how to live my life, but they were AA people. You know, they were telling me the things that I needed to do if I wanted to change my life. You know, get a sponsor, work the steps, you know, pray, the things that, you know, we do today in order to stay sober. And, you know, my excuse was, you know, I'm 22, I'm 23, you know, you guys don't know what you're talking about. You know, it's just a run of bad luck. You know, I'm 22, I can't be an alcoholic yet. So I didn't listen to it, you know, and I ended up going back out, and that lasted for another 2 years. So fast forward back to where we were, you know, college had failed, you know, being promoted at my job had failed, the military had failed, doing anything out of my own willpower had failed. You know, at that point I would try to stop drinking, and I would make it for maybe a day or two without that obsession kicking back in. And so where I ended up was, AA doesn't work because I've been there and it didn't work for me, so I'm going to die, I'm just going to kill myself. And a buddy of mine, who I grew up with, we played football together, lived a couple houses down. His mom was yelling at me in Spanish before I knew any Spanish. You know, we're just running buddies. I was going to die the same way he killed himself. And I was going to drive my car into a telephone pole and hopefully cut myself in half the way that he did. And I figured that would be heroic, to go out like my boy. Just the thinking. And the real unfortunate part of that story is that, you know, he never got to find this way of life, you know, because he had what we have. And so that's how I was going to do it. And I had set a date. It was like a week out or so. By this point, I'm going to work and I'm coming home. I'm trying not to go to the bar so I don't spend any money to get drunk. So I'm buying a 12-pack on the way home. You know, every other night I'm detoxing off something. You know, just sitting in the dark watching television or playing this one video game. And a couple days before I was going to... I don't know if I would have gone through with it, but a couple days before the deadline, I was watching an old black and white movie, which had Jack Lemmon in it. It's called A Day of Wine and Roses. It's about alcoholism. I didn't know what it was, or I probably would have changed the channel. But, you know, through detoxing off of God knows what and half already in the tank, you know, drinking Yinglings and Jack Daniels, you know, I had a moment of clarity and just realized that, you know, finally that alcohol is the real issue. And I fell down on my knees and asked whatever God that I used to have a relationship with, you know, I need help because I don't want to die, but I can't stop. I can't keep living this way. I'm hurting everybody around me, and I just can't bear to be awake. And it was the next day or 2 days after. I worked the late shift in the kitchen, and it was about 10 o'clock, and there's a knock on the apartment front door, and my brother's gone. And so I go to answer the door, and it's my dad, you know, and that was odd because he lived in Tampa and I was in Jacksonville. So he said, all right, wow. He said, go get a shirt on and come out in the living room, and, you know, I want to talk to you. So I did, and then this older gentleman walked in, a guy named Tom Sled. I don't know, some of you guys might know him. But basically, they asked me if I needed help, you know, that there was people in my life that loved me and were concerned about me, you know, the way I'd been behaving and acting and talking just craziness. And, you know, there's no, you know, you finally admit that you don't know how to stop. You ask God for help, and then help arrives. You know, there's no other explanation for it other than God. So, I was pretty out of my mind, but I agreed. You know, it was funny. It's funny now to hear the guy, the interventionist, Tom, talk about, you know, how that went down, because my younger brother is a big samurai sword fan, you know. And there was, you know, swords all in the living room, and, you know, you hear Tom tell the story about coming in, and he's just like, oh my God, what is this drunk going to do with a samurai sword when I walk in here? But I guess he had to be there, but I thought it's funny, so. So we came from Jacksonville, drove to here in Tampa to go to treatment. And we stopped at a McDonald's to get some food. They asked me if I was hungry. I thought they were going to analyze how much I ate to see how much of an appetite I had, to see how much drugs and alcohol I had been doing, when really they just wanted to know if I wanted a freaking hamburger. So, you know, the thinking was just so distorted. So I get to a place called Healthcare Connections. I was there for a 7-day evaluation, and I stayed for 92 days inpatient. Then I stayed in the halfway house portion, 3/4 is what they call it, for another 9 months, and then I started working there at a year sober. The blessing that I had coming into this program was that I was desperate. I don't know what just happened. I'm glad somebody else heard it. You know, I was desperate. You know, I knew that I didn't want any more of what I had. And so I did what they told me, you know. That perfectionism kicked in again. You know, I need to do it all just right. I asked the guy at the men's meeting, the Friday night men's YANA meeting. That was my first home group for about a year and a half. I asked the guy from there to sponsor me. He came to pick me up to do book work the first time from the treatment center, and he said, you need to come outside and get in the car. I'm like, I don't know if I can do that. He said, no, the doctor guy that runs the place, he said, you need to come get in the car, and I'm supposed to take you over to the hospital to, you know, go in the nut ward. And I'm like, all right. He's like, I'm just messing with you, man. I'm like, you mad? But that was my introduction to my sponsor. You know, and we've been through a lot together, you know, that guy and me. It took me about 3-4 steps to really share everything. Fifth steps. You know, I was one of those guys that wanted to hold on to that one thing that I did that set me apart, you know, that I was so ashamed to tell somebody else about. And it just kept me sick, man. You know, I told my sponsor, he's like, yeah, it happened. I did that, this, that, and that. I'm like, I wish I would have just been more honest from the get-go, because it would have saved me a lot of headaches. So. What I do want to make sure and include, though, is that in HCC, I don't know if they still do it, but when you first come in, they give you an upper buddy, you know, a guy who's been there a little while, he's progressed through a little bit of the program, and he's kind of like the guy you talk to get some questions answered. He's a friend. And my upper buddy's name was Bobby. And but I'll get to that at the end of my talk. So I lived at HCC. You know, I almost got kicked out once for talking to one of the girls and trying to force my own way, and I need to speed up. But I left working there because I wanted to, what specifically I told the guy, my employer, was I wanted to go and seek my fortune. You know, I had met a guy in this young people's group named Stan, and he's a good salesman, man, and he had talked me up about doing this kind of work. And you know, I really like Stan. He I was real serious when I was in here. You know, I knew the book back and forwards, and I could quote it to you. And you know, what you did wasn't right. You know, I had to tell you about it. And it caused a lot of problems for me, you know, in this group specifically, you know, for the first couple of years. You know, I wondered why I was feeling out of place, you know, while I'm full of self-righteous condemnation, you know. And I had a running buddy with that, a girl that I was seeing, and that that ended abruptly. But I really love this group, you know. I have really grown in here. You know, some of these guys in here have been with me through all of it, you know. And I feel real blessed to be a part of it, you know. On my fifth year of sobriety, they say that when you're on your fifth year, that your head pops out of your ass, that you know, can actually think again. The fifth year of my sobriety, to the date, I spoke here at my anniversary. We went to Tijuana Flats. I got a text message from the girl that I was dating for a year or two, that I had just broken up with, that she was pregnant. So my head popped out of my ass. From growing up in a strictly, very strict, you know, Christian household, you know, I learned how to, through this program, be okay with where I am as long as I'm doing my job. You know, I'm doing the steps, I'm talking to people, I'm trying to help, and I'm staying in contact with God. So instead of the strictly Christian way of, you know, you find, you date, you get married, you have a kid, you know, you buy a house, the whole thing. I had a kid, I bought a house, and I got married. So it went completely backwards. But, you know, I was able to share all of that with you guys, you know. And I wouldn't have it without you, you know. We've done some great things, you know. I've been involved in a lot of these young people's conferences. You know, we had one here. We went to California. You know, that I think that was a huge instrument for me, at least, in adding more people to the group, was, you know, the electricity that comes with a lot of that stuff. You know, working with people, getting close, talking about your stuff, seeing people relapse, you know, talking to them when they come back in. The constant for me throughout my sobriety, though, has been prayer. You know, I have three kids. Two I married into, one we have together. I'm a Cub Scout leader. I coach T-ball. I babysit when my wife does Girl Scouts. You know, my life is very full. You know, I travel for work. I'd love to be able to go to more meetings. That's just not possible sometimes. And what has kept me in these rooms is prayer, bar none. Be asking God to relieve me today of the desire to have that first drink or drug, or to want to kill myself or kill someone else, or to want to control my wife or to obsess about money. You know, that's been in my prayer for almost 10 years now. I worked the steps, and my life changed. You know, working with others, though, I think I learned more about myself and sponsoring other guys. The last thing that I want to talk about is my upper buddy, Bobby. When we were, you know, in treatment, and when they'd let us go to meetings outside, you know, he was one of those guys that always talked about, you know, my disease or my illness is out there doing push-ups waiting for me, you know, for when I get, if I go back out, you know, it's getting stronger, it's waiting for me. And Bobby was about my age, struggled with staying in the rooms, went out a few times, went to prison for a couple years, got back out, was doing okay for himself, had a couple kids, was about to get married, had a son named Jacob. My son's name's Jacob. Same age, we look similar. And I went to his funeral on Tuesday, and I cried my freaking eyes out. You know? Because that was the guy I put on a pedestal when I came in here, you know? He had his shit together. He knew what he was talking about. He's my age. Well, I can probably get sober if he's my age and he's doing it, you know? I got sober at 24, you know? And, you know, I'll never forget, while they're lowering his casket into the ground, you know, his son is standing there with his grandfather saying, "Where's Daddy? Where's Daddy?" And that's what's waiting for me out there, you know? I can't, you know... God. And I don't want to end, you know, there's a lot of hope in here, you know? I have three kids, you know? I testify in court for the largest financial institution in the country. You know, so obviously there's, you know, I've earned my trust back in the community about myself. You know, I have a boat. I own a 3,400 square foot house. Most of the time I'm happy with my wife. Probably less than that, she's happy with me. But, you know, there's plenty of stuff, you know. I can sit in a room full of my peers and feel okay, you know, and try to think more about how I can help them than how they can help me, you know. And those are the things that the hope that this program gives you, you know, and I wouldn't take that away for anything, but, you know, I also can't lose sight of, you know, what happens if I let all those good things that this program's given me, if I forget about them, or if I stop doing them, or just slowly walk away, you know, I could, you know, it could be my son asking, "Papa, where's, you know, where's Dad? Where is he?" You know? God, I can't imagine. So, on that note, you know, I owe my sobriety to the steps, to prayer, to my sponsor, and I can't exclude this group, you know? This group has constantly checked me, has constantly been my friends to lift me up when I needed help, and I hope it lasts a lot longer, you know. So, anything else will be rambling. So, thanks for letting me talk.